Did I tell y'all the story? I forget. Sam 57, I'm forgetting this stuff now. Did I tell y'all the story about when we went to freshman orientation at Georgia State? I tell y'all about this? Matthew, our youngest son, went to Georgia State. And so we went down to Georgia State. They had the freshman orientation. They had all the parents of the freshmen come into the gym down there where the Panthers play basketball and had this big orientation thing. And so they're telling you, oh, this is what you got to do. You got to do this. You got to do that. They said, do you have any questions? One parent raised their hand, and it was a question all these parents had on their mind. They said, how can I guarantee that my child will finish college in 4 years? Now, I'm thinking that's a good question because I'm thinking cheaper. It doesn't cost as much. I don't care about his education. I just don't want to spend as much money. Yeah. For him, though, I didn't want him to have to spend as much money on the loans he's going to have to take out. But it was like, and the teacher, one of the advisors said, I have the answer. So all the parents, you know, they're all getting out notebooks at this point because they want to write this down. Guarantee for 4 years. The advisor said, two things they must do, and I guarantee you, if they do this for 4 years, they will graduate in 4 years. Number one, go to class every time class is held. Number two, tell them they must do their homework. That was it. And someone, I think, said, wait a minute, could you repeat those again? Number one, tell them don't skip class. Go to every class, every time it's available, every time you can possibly go if you're not sick. Number two, always do your assignments. If you do those two things, you'll graduate in 4 years. And that's pretty simple. And when we come to the book of Hebrews, we say, how do I get to heaven? Here it is. Number one, don't do anything stupid. Number two, don't quit. Now, that's pretty simple. Now, it's not easy. Because you're like me, you're prone to stupidity. But don't do anything stupid, and don't quit. And that's really what the book of Hebrews says. And that's what we've been kind of saying all along. And we're going to continue that idea today and break it down as we've been breaking it down. Jesus is preeminent. Jesus is permanent. Jesus is persevering. And that's all we have to remember from the book of Hebrews about how to remain faithful. What the Hebrew writer has been doing is this. The Hebrew Christians were tempted to go back to the legalized, safe religion of Judaism because the Romans weren't killing them. They were killing the Christians, the new cult. And so the Hebrew writer comes on and he basically says, be faithful, be stupid, don't quit. But let me tell you something. The thing you're wanting to go back to is slowly being removed. There are four cornerstones to the Jewish religion. The Sabbath, Levitical priesthood, the Old Covenant, temple worship. The Sabbath, Levitical priesthood, the covenant, the law of Moses, and temple worship. And what he does is, he's slowly pulling each of those cornerstones out the more that we move into the book. He's already pulled out the Sabbath, saying, well, there's a better rest, the rest of Jesus. Last week, we talked about how he pulled out the Levitical priesthood, because that's gone. It's the priesthood of Melchizedek now, right? Then he's going to pull out the law of Moses, the old covenant, which we're going to talk about today. Next week, we're going to pull out the temple worship and sacrifices. And those things are gone. They say, if you go back to that, he's saying, you can go back to that if you want to, but in a very short time, that's going to be done away with anyway. You're going back to something that's not going to be long for this world. And in 8 years, it was all gone. Romans came into Jerusalem at the last rebellion, destroyed it all, burned the temple to the ground. And for that day in 70 AD, for all intents and purposes, the religion of Judaism was gone. It's lasted in a sense, but it is gone. And that's why he says, don't go back to that, because it won't last. Jesus comes on the scene and says, go with me because I'm permanent and because that stuff was not meant to last. Chapter 5 of the book of Matthew, starting in verse 17. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law of the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter nor the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Jesus is saying here, and this is when he first fires the first salvo, the first shot across the bow of Judaism, he's saying, it is about to be fulfilled. It's about to go away. I am the fulfillment of the law. I am the accomplishment of the law. I am what the law has been pointing to all along. So don't put yourself into that because it's about to be done away with. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 8, it says Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He's what the law was all leading up to, and they just got confused. Sometimes we think, you think about this, we think about stuff that is temporary, that's leading to permanency, but we like to stick with the temporary. We like to stick with the flash and the cash. But the flash and the cash is leading to something else. But we get, and that's what Satan wants you to do. He wants you to think that the flash and the cash is what is important. What is temporary. But it's all leading up to something else, that God has something better in store for us. But we get stuck on that. Most of the world gets stuck on that. And that's why they never see God. Jesus is permanent. All this other stuff is going away. Now, if you go over to Hebrews chapter 7, that's where we're going to start, Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 22. What we're going to do today, I tried to figure out the best way to do this, and we're going to do a little wax on, wax off today. Okay? That means we're going to jump here, jump there, jump blah, 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 all the way around. But when you actually have to do the fight at the Valley Karate Tournament, you'll win. Okay? Hebrews chapter 7, verse 22. Because of this, Jesus has become the guarantee of a better covenant. Okay? Now, he talks about that all in chapter 8. We're going to go back and talk really chapter 8 through chapter 9 and verse through chapter 9 and verse 10. And then chapter 11 through verses 11 through 14 of chapter 9, they really go more with starting in chapter 10. So we're not going to look at chapter 9, verses 11 through 14 today. They really talk more about sacrifice. He's kind of introducing the concept of the sacrifice, and that fits in more with chapter 10. So we're going to do really all of chapter 8, maybe verses 1 through 10 of chapter 9, and then talking about the permanency of Jesus' covenant is permanent. Now, I want you to look at some key words with me, though, first of all. Let's look in chapter 8 and verse 13. There's four words I want us to talk about just for a minute. By calling this covenant new, he has made the first one obsolete. And what is obsolete and aging will soon disappear. What is absolute and aging will soon disappear. There are four words that are really key to understanding the covenant, the concept of Jesus' permanent covenant. Number one is obsolete. He said the old covenant is obsolete. It's literally old in years, is the Greek word, is what it means. And we get our English word paleontology from it, the study of old stuff, right? Paleontology, if you took that in class in college, it was just a study of old stuff. That's what all that's about. And that's what the Greek word is, I believe it's paleontos or something like that. And so he says, the old covenant is obsolete. Then he says, the old covenant is aged. It's aging. It is of old age. I understand that word better after Thursday. It's old age. He says it's aging. John chapter 3 and verse 4. John chapter 21 and verse 18. Jesus refers to certain things as being old. The old man. The old life. Something's getting older. Old garments. It's something that is aging. That's the word that he uses right here. The English word, I believe the Greek word is something like grapos. You know what the English word is? Gray. That's where we get our English word gray from. So he says, it's old in years and it's gray. And then he says, it is disappearing. That means to vanish or to be abolished. So the old covenant, he uses all these words to say, don't put your hope in something that is old in years, that is graying, and is about to vanish anyway. Now, whether that is a law, whether that is a way of life, whether it is a job, whether it is a relationship, a worldly relationship, I'm hoping Christy's not wanting to do away with me because I'm old and graying and vanishing, you know. But anything like that, he says, don't put your hope in that. And we have got to, you know, how many people in California put their hope in those houses? How many people? How about those two guys this past week? The head of Chase and the head of City, was it Citibank? Were both let go. Now, they were let go with a pretty good golden parachute. But I don't think it's about golden parachutes. Those guys, they are concerned about power, as most of those people are. That's all gone for them at this point. Don't put your hope in something that is old and aging and vanishing, is what he says. He says the covenant, verse 22 of chapter 7, is a better covenant. Now, I want you to write these verses down, because the word better is key in the book of Hebrews. The word better. It is used on 9 different occasions. Chapter 6 and verse 9. Just write down I'll tell you the words and you write down the verse and then we'll go on. Chapter 6 and verse 9. We have better things that accompany salvation. Chapter 7 and verse 19. We have a better hope. Chapter 7 and verse 22. We have a better covenant. Chapter 8 and verse 6. We have better promises. Chapter 9, verse 23, we have better sacrifices. Chapter 10, verse 34, we have better and lasting possessions. Chapter 11, and verse 16, we are looking for a better country. Chapter 11, and verse 35, there is a better resurrection. Chapter 11 and verse 30 and verse 40. There is something better prepared for them by God. So 6:9, 7:19, 7:22, 8:6, 9:23, 10:34, 11:16, 11:35, 11:40. Better is used in every one of those verses. The word itself, not something is better in use, other words, but the actual word better is used. What does that tell you? I'd say that's a pretty important word in the book of Hebrews, wouldn't you? That's, you know, I'm not a smart man. That's not hard to figure out. That what we have is better. And that's what he was telling them. What you have is better. You've gotten into something better. Don't leave the better and go back to what is not as good. Figure it out. You know what happens to us a lot of times, I think, is that Satan comes on to us when we're having a hard time and he says, you know, it was really better when you used to not be a Christian. Doesn't he tell you that? And sometimes we just fall for that. It's too bad we just didn't make a videotape and have our lives on video and then we go back and play that tape and say, was this really better? Was the bar scene really better? Was that relationship really better? Was it really better when you didn't pray? Was it really better when you couldn't read your Bible every day? Was it really better when you didn't have people helping you to go further in your relationship with God? Was that really better? Uh-uh. Not when I think the drink through, remember? I'm going to think that drink through. When I think the drink through, I realize it wasn't better. The new covenant is better. Look in chapter 8. Verses 8 through 12. And we're going to talk about something else about the covenant. But God found fault with the people and said, well, let's start in verse 7, I'm sorry. For if there had been nothing wrong with that first covenant, no place would have been sought for another. That makes sense. But God found fault with the people and said, the time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt because they did not remain faithful to my covenant. And I turned away from them, declares the Lord. So God had set up this new covenant and had all these rules and regulations, and it was something created by God. Now it was leading to something else, but for them, it was perfect for them. And he said, I give you rules and regulations. You were born a Jew. You had to follow the rules and regulations. He said, but after a while, it just didn't work anymore for you. This is a covenant I will make with the house of Israel. After that time, declares the Lord, I will put my laws in their minds and write them on their hearts. Oh, wait a minute. That's different. Before you had those two big old blocks of stones and all that stuff written down. No, we're not going to do that anymore. I will be their God. They will be my people. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother say, know the Lord. Because they will all know me from the least of them to the greatest. Finally, I found the verse that says I don't have to be evangelistic. I've been looking for that for years. Whew, now the pressure's off. You know, that's a hard verse to understand. And I don't know that I understand it completely, but I think this is what he's talking about. Used to, when if you were born a Jew, you're a Jew. But if you're not a Jew, they would proselyte you. And so any non-Jews or Gentiles, they had to go through a process in order to become Jews. They had to be taught, they had to be trained, had to go to Jewish school, whatever that may have been, I'm not sure. Had to do all that stuff, and then they could become Jews. But if you were born a Jew, you were just a Jew. You weren't taught anything. Are you a Jew? Yeah, I'm a Jew. Yeah. Law of Moses? Law of Moses. Why? I was born into it. But if you were taught that way, you had to be taught into it. What he's saying here, I think, is this. Is that the new covenant? Is that we're born into Christianity? John chapter 3, right? Born of the water, the blood, born of the Spirit. We're born into it, and we're disciples. We have to be taught. Of course, he's not talking about not teaching here. He's talking about that you're born into it now, and so now it's on your heart and your minds. You don't have to go through all these classes after you become a Christian to do that. You just are born into it when you're baptized. Say, well, what does that mean for me? Well, I think it means this. I think it means after you're baptized, if you don't do anything stupid, you don't quit, you're going to heaven. But what about all these things I'm supposed to obey? I think you'll obey them. Because you became a Christian anyway because you love God. And you'll figure out a lot of this stuff as you go along the way. But just don't do anything stupid and don't quit and you're still a Christian. And you're on your way to heaven. Am I on my way to heaven? Yes, I am. Are you? Yes, you are. The fact that you're here today tells me you're on your way to heaven. Don't do anything stupid. Don't quit. Write down 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 7 through 18. And he talks more about that, about the thing being on the heart and so forth, and about what a heart should look like. And that'll help out a little bit with that. Oh, I'm sorry. 2 Corinthians 3, 7 through 18. 2 Corinthians 3, 7 through 18. Also, the context of chapter 8 that we read, verses 8 through 12, that is Jeremiah 31, 31 through 34. Go back and read that as well. Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 through 34, was the first prophecy about the new covenant. Jeremiah 31, 31 through 34. Verse 13, by calling the first covenant new, he has made this covenant new. He has made the first one obsolete, and what is obsolete and aging will soon disappear. Now let's start in chapter 9 and verse 1. Because we want to talk about this concept of the covenant, but I want you to think about it in a totally different way. I wish Steve was in here today, because he's a contract lawyer. Maybe he'll listen to the tape and help us with this even so. Now, the first covenant had regulations for worship and also an earthly sanctuary. Tabernacle was set up. Its first room was the lampstand, the table, the consecrated bread. This was called the holy place. Behind the second curtain was a room called the most holy place, which had a golden altar of incense and the gold-covered ark of the covenant. Now, y'all have all seen that before because you've seen Raiders of the Lost Ark. And that, by the way, is what the ark looked like. That's pretty close to what it really looked like. I saw a picture of it recently. I thought, that's pretty close. This ark contained the gold jar of manna. Remember they had that manna, they had pig gut, well, they put a bunch of them in a jar and put it in the ark. Aaron's staff that had budded, and the stone tablets of the covenant. Above the ark were the cherubim, The glory overshadowing the atonement cover, but we cannot discuss these things in detail now, which I think is kind of funny because that's just what he did. He probably won't talk about it more. When everything had been arranged like this, the priests entered regularly into the outer room to carry on their ministry. That's what they did. But only the high priest entered the inner room, and that only once a year, and never without blood, which he offered for himself and for the sins of people committed to ignorance. J.P. Tynes told this one time, and I didn't know about it. He'd done some study on it. This is pretty, I always think this is pretty funny. The high priest would go in there once a year into the most holy place, but he's the only guy who could go in there. And what they used to do was they used to tie a rope around him. Because he did something stupid when he's in there, they'd pull him out. And I just had this, that just always seemed rather funny to me. You know, you imagine, Harry, we need to put the rope around you right now. Don't do anything stupid while you're in there. We'll have to, because we're not coming in after you. You understand that. It's like, well, thanks for the confidence in me. But that's what they do. And then they pull him out. And they never had to pull anybody out. History doesn't say they ever did. But that's what they did. And so he'd go in there once a year. And he would make the sacrifices for the people. This is all part of the old covenant. The Holy Spirit was shown by this that the way into the most holy place has not yet been disclosed as long as the first tabernacle was still standing. Temporary. This is an illustration for the present time, indicating that the gifts and sacrifices being offered were not able to clear the conscience of the worshiper. They are only a matter of food and drink and various ceremonial washings, external regulations applying until the time of the new order. Jump down to verse 15. For this reason, Christ is a mediator of a new covenant that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance now that he has died as a ransom to set them free from the sins committed under the first covenant. Jesus has a new covenant, set us free from the sins committed under the first covenant. Jesus has a new covenant. Now the word here used, and we're going to talk in verses 16 through 21 in a second. There are two words used for covenant in the New Testament. It's the same word, one word, but it means two separate things. One word means contract. The other word means will, or a will. A contract to the Jews, to us today, is a legal binding agreement between two parties. Okay? One party says, I'll do this if you do that. The other party says, well, I'll agree to that if you'll do this. And it crosses, it goes over. Both of them have obligations. Both of them have rewards from fulfilling the contract. If either one of the parties breaks the contract, then the binding agreement is off. So you bought a house, you signed a contract, right? You don't pay your part of the contract, they come back and take your house. You buy a car, you sign a contract for that car. If you don't pay for the car, the repo man comes in the middle of the night and hauls your car off. That's called a contract. The other concept for contract or covenant in the book of Hebrews, in the New Testament, in fact, is the word will. It's a will. And it is not a contract. A will is when somebody gives somebody something else. It is a single disposition from one person to another, a gift. Okay? Now the person who receives a gift gets the gift, and it's theirs whether they want it or not. They don't have to go get it. If they get it, they can give it away. They're under no obligation when they're the receiver of the will. As far as I can understand, because of what he says, and we're going to read in just a second, verse 16. When he's talking about the contract, the covenant between us and God, he is not talking about a legal contract between two parties. Equal obligations, equal requirements. He's not talking about that. He's talking about a will disposition. Now, you say, well, what does it matter? It matters a lot, I think. Because people who think they're under a contract with God almost always leave. Because they think God, most of the time, didn't fulfill the terms of His contract. You didn't bless me like you said you would. You told me if I became a Christian and gave up everything, that this would happen. That didn't happen like I thought it was. You really have not fulfilled your end of the bargain, God. Or you did something I didn't think was part of the contract. Was that in the small print? Didn't read that. And so I'm going to be like most major sports stars today. I'm simply going to either renegotiate my contract, which we try and do, and if God doesn't want to renegotiate, which God doesn't do, we leave. If you think you're in a contract relationship with God, you will probably eventually leave. Because you're going to think at one point God broke the terms of the contract or you didn't read the small print. Okay? How about a will? That's different. A will says, God says, this is yours. Do with it as you will. Gift, grace, free. You can give it away. You can keep it. It's all yours. You do with it as you wish, as you please. And I think that's what he's talking about here. And I think that's why he brings up verse 16, because he says, in the case of a will, it is necessary to prove the death of the one who made it, because the will is in force only when somebody has died. That's Jesus. It never takes effect while the one who made it is living. That's why even the first covenant was not put into effect without blood. When Jesus had proclaimed, when Moses had proclaimed every commandment of the law to all the people, he took the blood of calves, together with water, scarlet wool, branches of hyssop, and sprinkled the scroll on all the people. He said, this is the blood of the covenant which God has commanded you to keep. In the same way, he sprinkled with blood both the tabernacle and everything used in it in ceremonies. In fact, the law requires that nearly everything be cleansed with blood. Without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. And he's basically setting you up for chapter 10. It was necessary then for the copies of the heavenly things, what? A will, to be purified with these sacrifices, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ did not enter a man-made sanctuary that was only a copy of the true one. He entered heaven itself, now to appear for us in God's presence. Nor did he enter heaven to offer himself and again, the way the high priest enters the most holy place, every year with blood that is not his own. Then Christ would have had to suffer many times since the creation of the world. But now he has appeared once for all at the end of the ages to do away with sin by the sacrifice of himself. Just as man is destined to die once and after that to face the judgment, so Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many people, and he will appear a second time not to bear sin, but to bring salvation to those who are waiting for him, to those who have received the disposition of the will. You know, when I think of a contract, that's hard. When I think of being the receiver of a will, that's kind of cool. I've got two rich uncles who live in Newport News, Virginia. They are wealthy beyond anything I would ever dream of. I'm not in their will. They don't even know where I am. The truth is, I don't even know if they are both still living. They are that far removed from our family. A lot of us, if we had two rich uncles who were dying, we'd hope he's in their will, wouldn't we? I hope I'm in their will. I don't think I am. You know what? You've got a rich uncle who died. You got that rich uncle who died. And you are in the will. And you only got to do two things to receive the disposition of the will. Number one, don't do anything stupid. And number two, don't give up. Don't quit. And you receive all the disposition of the will. My thinking is that the covenant of Jesus is a better and more permanent covenant than what these people could have ever possibly have gone to. So, the Sabbath has been pulled away. The covenant has been pulled away. What was the second one? Huh? The priesthood's been pulled away. The whole thing's tottering right now. We're going to pull the next one away in, I think, 3 weeks. And then we'll finish that up and we'll start to begin talk about, now here's how you persevere. You follow the author and perfecter of our faith, the persevering Jesus. Thank you for being here today. Don't forget your kids.